Author of the Week with Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
When a meth lab bust goes bad, Detective Jessica Ramirez finds herself banished to Flagstaff, Arizona, in pursuit of a serial killer who targets bad guys who got away with it. Jess and her partner, computer forensic expert Alexandra Clark, soon discover that their perp is involved in something much deeper and much more deadly. Surrounded by an ensemble cast of fascinating characters, Jess and Ellie race against the clock to try and prevent a cyber terror attack that could change the course of history. Not my words, but the tantalizing words of ace author Terry Shepherd in the wonderful world of Chasing Vega. How are you, Terry?
Alex, it is great to be on Siren Radio and in that beautiful, I'm just imagining what it's like there right now, this time of year. I'm a huge Anglophile, know that part of the country very well, and it's just great to be on the radio with you today.
Well, Terry, we're delighted to actually have you on board. As you can see, we're celebrating by having a full backdrop of your good self in every sense of the word. And we've also been joined by one of our lovely level two, but soon to be level three journalism undergraduates, who is also developing her own podcast, of course, with Elise. That's Gabriella Van Genians. How are you, Gabriella?
Hi, Alex. Hi, Terry. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
We're fantastic. Slated. It's great to meet you, Gabriella. I want to hear about your podcast.
Oh, well, our podcast is called Don't Stand So Close to Me, and you can follow it on Spotify, so give it a follow. And it's basically about everything in the pandemic that we've kind of learned so far.
Yeah.
Everything. So our next one is going to be with Juliette Lamar, who's a podcaster, actress, writer. She's pretty much everything. And we're talking about travel, basically.
Oh,
my
God.
How after the pandemic, you know, we just want to travel and want to be able to go places, that kind of thing.
I'm going to plug that into my podcatcher, Gabriella, because that is exactly the kind of stuff I love to listen to. And the travel one, I'm very interested in that, because one of my great disappointments last fall was not to be able to come back to the UK for Capital Crimes, which is one of the biggest European mystery writer conventions. It happens right in downtown London. And as I was telling Alex, I love your country. I wish I could become one of you.
Don't worry. Joe Biden's trying to do that. So all's well with the world. I'm sure everything
will
work out. Our
special relationship continues. That's great.
Exactly.
You have to come to Lincoln. You have to come to Lincoln.
Yes,
get fish and chips and everything.
Well, and I know that part of the country. I was so great, so excited to be on Siren Radio with all of you guys, because I do know that part of the world, and it's just beautiful there. I'd love to come hang out with all of you. It'd be fantastic.
Well, yes. Sorry, we'd love to have you. And as we progress onwards, as you said in your original email, always nice to explore the Jessica-verse. And who better than our very own Jessica, graduate now of Appalachia State University, and of course, a exchange student with the University of Lincoln. It's Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
Hello, I'm doing pretty well. How are you all?
We're splendid. We've already had a shameless plug for Gabriella's podcast with wonderful Midweek Drivette, who launched the whole thing with Juliette Lamar. So nice to see that she's moving on from there. Let's move on to yourself, Jessica. And as we correctly identified yesterday, it's Chasing Vega, not Chasing Vegans, in case people think that Terry's writing about people who have a particular nutritional approach that you're heading
I've never to. Heard that one before, Alex. That's great. I'm using just, that line.
Just that extra consonant, it could open up all sorts of things from there. Jessica, any questions you'd like to put to Terry?
I'm very curious about how you kind of came up with the detective plot with a serial killer theme like that. How did you think up that? Has this always been an interest for you?
Well, you know, the way that Jessica came to be is that I have a very good friend who is, in fact, a Latina detective, and she has been for 25 years. And she was one of the first in her force to be a female cop and a minority cop. And she had a rough time. And we're very good friends, and she would tell me her stories, and not all of them had happy endings. So being an author, I said to her, why don't I write about you, but let you win some things every now and then? So that's how the Jessica Ramirez character came to be. And the best thrillers have just horrible villains. So I was trying to think of the most creative way, a new way that I could create my favorite type of antagonist, Jess, which is somebody that's doing the right things for the wrong reasons. you know, Vega kills bad guys who got away. And so Jess has, if you've read the book, Jess kind of has a little struggle with that because she's helping out. They calculate how much it costs to house a killer or a, you know, a violent criminal for a lifetime, and it's zillions of dollars. And Vega's point of view is she's saving the country money, but she has a darker purpose. And that ultimately becomes the thing that Jess chases her for, is to try and stop her from doing that damage.
I think it's a very interesting moral conundrum, kind of that idea of like, what's the greater evil here to do? I think that's, how did you go about trying to answer that yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, the very interesting thing about writing, when you immerse yourself as an author, is that these people begin to populate your brain and start talking to you. So a lot of the research I did, my process is that I start out with a rough plot idea. So I had the idea that I knew I wanted to have this ensemble cast of very diverse characters, you know, Jess being Latina, Alexandra Clark, her partner, being LGBTQ. The guy I get the most mail about is Joey Price, the medical examiner who's on the autism spectrum. People love him. They think he's fantastic. So I needed to, once I knew who this cast was going to be and had a rough idea of the story, then the research began. And that's, you can't walk in somebody's shoes, but you can walk beside them. So I spent lots and lots of time with cops. And, you know, my wife and I have a ton of friends who are in the LGBT community. We're huge allies. And my best friend and best man, his son is on the spectrum and is this brilliant computer guy. So I was able to work through with him, to talk with him about how he discovered that he was on the spectrum, what it felt like in his brain and the challenges he had communicating. And I tried to imbue the characters with that kind of authenticity so that they would, you know, they would, when somebody reads the book, if you are part of any of those groups, I want you to feel like you could be that hero too. And when I do hear from readers that say, hey, I'm a young person of color, a young woman of color, and I'm thinking about a law enforcement career, that just makes my day. When that happens, I know it's a success. I don't even care about book sales after that.
Having checked out Jess's journal, I'm fascinated by Jessica Ramirez's own view. I mean, is that something which you had to channel? Was it a case of sorting through the whole thing? Or was it a case of, look, there's no such thing as a fictional character. They're real in a different universe.
That's, you know, I try to imagine that they're real. Before I even wrote the book, I created DET Jess Ramirez on Twitter. So Jess has a Twitter handle, and I'm very clear that she's a fictional character. But people refuse to believe that because, you know, she interacts. Part of what I'm trying to learn is who she is and how she would communicate. And she talks about safety, and she shows a lot of these videos where people are making bad decisions and, you know, the kind of stuff you see on Reddit and stuff where people are wrecking their cars and things. And she talks about that stuff, and other cops are engaging with her. So the interesting thing that you guys will especially find interesting is that she has a huge following in the UK. UK cops love Jessica Ramirez. And so my mail from them was, bring her here. You know, they first they think she's real. So they say, next time you come over, will you please bring her? We don't want to be with you. We want to be with her. But they said, next story has to have a Great Britain component. So Chasing the Captain, which comes out next week to my beta readers in a couple of weeks after to the world, has a large part of the story in London, because the one guy that got away in Chasing Vega, Vega's boss, happens to be the chairman of the board. He's a Russian guy, chairman of the board of a London corporation. And so Jessica ultimately finds her way there to chase him. So that was a surprise for me to figure out that this person that I had created was considered to be so real by her audience that they wanted to have relationships with her. She's received two marriage proposals, which just cracked me up. I'm writing back and I'm saying, hey, I'm Terry Shepard. I created Jessica. She's fake. She's not real. And it was like, Alex is probably old enough to remember that the great Marilyn Monroe movie, Some Like It Hot, where at the end, Jack Lemmon, who's been playing a woman throughout the whole movie, is sitting next to Joey Ross, and he pulls off his wig and he says, I'm a man. And Joey Ross says, nobody's perfect. No. And that's what this guy said to me when I explained that Jess was fake. He said, well, can I have her email address anyway? I want to correspond with her. So that's what happens. If you've done it right, you've created a character that feels so real that people want to have a relationship with that person.
I'm not too sure what it says about the state of the British police force if they believe that actually a fictional character is real, but let's not go there. step away from that. Mind you, it's fair to say that many people actually believe that our Prime Minister is a fictional character in any case, so we'll, it could happen. Gabriella, let's turn to your good self, because you, of course, have got, I believe, a mixture of Spanish and Dutch blood and various other things in your good self.
Yeah,
I've got, like, Dutch blood. My mum is half Colombian from South America. My dad grew up in the US, in Boston, so it's kind of like... That is what I love about the book. That's what I was going to say, Terry. Like, the strong female badass characters, we need more of them, which I love. And I was going to ask you, how long did it take you to write this book? Did you write this book in the pandemic?
No, actually, I wrote it. I finished it just as the pandemic was starting. So it was in process. The way that my process works is that when the book is finished, I have a story consultant. So that's somebody who looks at the characters and the plot to make sure that the characters are authentic enough and the plot works. And then once we figured those things out, I send it to an editor. And, that's the person who corrects my grammar and sees if there's things out of place and stuff. And then I have a group of beta readers. I have about 20 people that get to look at it first. And it includes a lot of police officers. It includes people, everybody that looks and feels like the characters that are in the book gets a shot at that story before I publish it to tell me what's right and what's wrong. And then when I'm done with that, the last thing I do is I narrate it. So I actually read it one more time so I can see, that's where I find the last stuff. And then it goes to publication. So that process, the actual process of writing, once I finished the research, was about 3 months, because that was my first Jessica Ramirez thriller. The pandemic got in the way of Chasing the Captain. I had Chasing the Captain 3/4 done. And then I stumbled onto Juliet and the Mystery Bug. And that is a kid's book that I wrote because I have two grandchildren who asked me and said, "Grandpa, we're afraid of this whole COVID thing. What can we do to protect ourselves?" So I contacted the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and said, "How do you do it? If you were going to write a book, what would be the things you would want to teach?" And what I did was I created a picture book that's written in poetry style, like Dr. Seuss used to write. Alex and I remember what that guy was like when we were growing up. And I created that book, and it's taken off. It's become a thing. It teaches masking, social distancing, and it teaches the science behind vaccines. And it's in many doctors' offices. Right now, I have a guy that's walking around Washington talking to the Centers for Disease Control about getting an endorsement for the book. So that was something that kind of got in the way. I didn't expect that to happen. I never expected to be a children's book author. And it slowed me down on Captain. But the story in Captain was so compelling. In fact, you know, Gabrielle, you're going to love this, because Jessica's counterpart with the Met in London is another person of mixed heritage. She's half South African and half Scottish. So you have, So basically you have Jessica, who's Latina, and a cop who looks very black, working together on this cold case of a dead woman that this cop in London claims that she saw 10 years earlier. They're grasping at this string. And it was so much fun because I got to learn about South Africa. and I found a couple of friends down there that were authors. And I said, "Teach me about what these people are like." And it brought back for me, you know, I grew up in a time when apartheid was still a thing, and back when it was very white down there, and had seen all those changes. So I wanted to inject into the character of Leanna Evans, she calls herself Lee, who's the other star of Chasing the Captain, all of that history. But also, you know, the Scots are very fascinating people too. And I have Scottish blood in me. My ancestors are partially from the UK as well. So that was a kind of an ancestral journey for me. That's what I love about writing, guys, is it's just it's an opportunity to create, like the Jessica verse, create a world, but also to try and make it as authentic and create characters that are not only believable, but I love it when somebody says, "Hey, why did you write about me?" You know, that's me. Why are you telling my secrets in your story? I know I've done well when that happens.
Authors write what they know about. One of our regular contributors, of course, is the producer and writer Arthur Weingarten, who, of course, wrote for Jessica Fletcher, Murder, She Wrote, various other things. Something about Jessica, obviously. Let's turn to our Jessica. They're just proliferating like all sorts of Jessica things today.
I know. I'm loving hearing this. I can just cosplay so many different Jessicas. I'll have some awesome videos. Although something I am curious about is how I saw on your website that the book had been translated into Spanish.
Yes.
And I don't speak Spanish. So I'm very curious about, like, how was that process, of working with a translated copy?
Yeah. I mean, I do speak and read Spanish, but I don't trust myself to write in Spanish. So what I did was I went out and I tried to find somebody who already had credentials in that space to be a co-author. And what I told her was, make the story your own. You know, use the fundamental plot points of this fish out of water story of a woman that's banished to, Arizona, and keep the main characters, but make it something that will resonate with the Latino audience. Specifically, my goal was South America. And she, she's from Peru originally. And so that's what she did. And then, I hired another editor for that Spanish version who has a European Spanish background and is very, has a PhD in Spanish literature. So those two kind of got into it. What happens a lot of times between editor and author is that there are disagreements, right? The editor will say, nah, I can't work that way. And the author says, well, that's the way I want it to work. And you have to come to an agreement of how that's going to work. So watching the dynamic between those two saying, wait a minute, this is not what Jessica meant when she said this in English. What you're saying is one thing and what I really think is the other. And to watch them negotiate to what became the final manuscript was really fun. But what's even more fun is that it's being used in a class at the University of Texas right now, a Spanish literature class. And there are 117 kids in the class. And what they agreed to do for me, Jess, is at the end of the term, they took a survey to populate the film. So I asked them who should play who in the movie. So I have all this data from them of, because I'm not hip to the current young stars, but they are. And so what my next thing is right now is I've had several Hollywood meetings, and I'm trying to go directly to those people through their agents. Because what happens now, the way movies are made, is Tom Cruise says, I want to be Jack Reacher. And Lee Child says, that's not who I wrote Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher's nothing like
Tom,
you. But
Tom Cruise is not going to be Jessica. It just wouldn't work.
No, but
he's an actor, wrote Jack.
Yeah, so I don't know whether it'll be J-Lo or who it'll ultimately be. But that's my goal, is to go to that person and say, look, your fans want this person to be you. Take a look at the book. And that's been exciting. That's a whole new dimension. The Hollywood piece is something that in my other life, I do narrations, and I've done movie trailers and stuff as a voice guy. So I know a lot of people out there, but it's a whole different world when you've got a story you're peddling and trying to get them excited about spending $50 million to have it produced.
One of the things I really like about your blog, which of course you can access through terryshepherd.com, is a line, life is a series of choices. The attitudes we choose and how we express them determine the outcomes we get. It's a deep philosophy, that. Just a few words, really, Terry. Would you like to expand?
Yeah, well, I mean, I never, ever thought that I would become an author. When I grew up, I had kind of three goals. When I was a really little kid, I wanted to be a railroad engineer. Then I wanted to be a rock drummer. Then I wanted to be a disc jockey. And I was lucky enough to be able to do all of those things. But I realized very quickly that if I was going to have a family and support them, I needed to have some sort of career which would throw off cash flow. So then I got in the corporate world. I became a corporate guy for a long time. And I thought a lot about all the choices that I made along the way and how I could have done, at any juncture, I could have made a decision that might have totally changed my life. And in Jessica's case, you look at her flaw is also her strength, and that's her connection with her family, right? So the decision she makes, she's wanted, you know, the FBI wants her to come to work in Washington. She could be a police chief somewhere else, but she won't leave the city of Paloma because she cares about her family. That's a decision that had consequences and ultimately led to, you know, her father's death by that assassin. And that's part of what she struggles with as she's going into chasing the captain, is she's still mourning him. She wants revenge. But what she learned, as you all know from reading Chasing Vega, is that the revenge you think you're getting doesn't necessarily give you the feeling that you hoped it would. And I think that was her biggest learning in the story. And, you know, I think about that in life too. You know, when we have, we see these things and we just love to see the people that bullied us go down. And sometimes when they do, what you feel is compassion and empathy. You don't feel like, yeah, I'm glad that happened. And so that's it. You know, when you're thinking about the choices you're making in life, everyone is really worth considering very deeply and very carefully, because you never know. It might be the profound choice that totally changes your direction.
Clearly, you're currently on the Midweek Drive. It's the Authors of the Week feature, or Author of the Week in many ways. We've already promoted The Joys of Gabriella and Don't Stand So Close to Me, but close to me even. But Terry, you are a podcaster yourself. You've also got a range of things going. So share with us, what magical things do you offer to the wonderful world of podcasting?
Well, you know, this is, Gabrielle, this is why I'm glad you're doing what you're doing, because I got into podcasting because I needed to find a way to be able to talk with other people that were authors. So my friend and now partner, Pam Stack, who runs the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, asked me to substitute for her while she was having cataract surgery. And because I got a broadcast background and know how to do it, you know, I could do it relatively easy. And I realized that I got time before and after these conversations that we record to really find out more about those people. I'm fascinated. I would love to be there and go out to lunch with you two, with you, Gabriella, and you, Jessica, just to hear your story. I would love to learn more about that. And that's what I got to do at the end. You know, I'm talking to these guys who've written these amazing books and are, you know, New York Times bestselling authors about the craft. So I decided, when she said, please, will you just take the show? I decided to do that. And so I've done less lately for some reason. I think there's been so much promotion going on with Vega that I've been kind of distracted by that. But that's one thing. And then, you know, the whole social media thing, managing multiple identities, managing Jessica's, managing my own on many platforms requires time. And a lot of people outsource that. And I'm sure you ladies can tell when it's not the real person who's handling the Twitter feed or the Facebook feed, because there isn't that authenticity. It's the one way that I can really connect up close and personal with my audience, because they come to me with a bit of their lives and I'm fascinated to hear about what they're doing and I want to interact with them about it. And it ultimately, some of those stories find their way into my writing. So my whole, all the extracurricular activities that I do funnel back to my current passion, which is storytelling and everything involved with the process of writing and publication. But Alex, there's a deeper thing to this, and that is purpose, right? We all think about why we're put on this earth. And especially, you know, Jess and Gabriella, you two are wrestling with that right now. What am I here for? What am I supposed to do? And
because they're good Midweek Drive editors, Terry, it's quite simple. We wouldn't invite them on the show if they couldn't cope, if they couldn't cut the mustard. End of.
Well, but you know what? I think it just, for me, it distills into alleviating suffering. It's a very Buddhist thing to say, but I mean, we're here to make the world a little bit better, right? Whatever we do, it should make the world better. And my goal with writing the books is to try and inspire people to believe that they can live above and beyond their potential, that they can reach for the stars. And that's what drives me every day to create, is that I'm hoping that there will be at least one person out there that will benefit from that. So that's the deeper kind of philosophical thing that drives everything that I do, is that purpose.
I'm just impressed, Terry, with the Chasing Vega iPhone case, the Chasing Vega mug. The baseball caps, the Authors on the Air vintage cotton twills. I mean, it's the merchandise is clearly there and is working, which is brilliant.
Well, you go where the audience is, right? I mean, there's an old saying that you don't have to throw the party, you just got to be at the party. So what I try and do is figure out where the audience for the Jessica Ramirez character might be. If you think about the reason why Disney bought Marvel Studios and Lucasfilm, they didn't buy it for the films. They bought it for the characters and the, what the characters will do in the future. And so my goal with Jessica is to purpose her everywhere. I'm working right now on a graphic novel version of Chasing Vega, because the comic book fans are just rabid. If they fall in love with you, you know, they buy everything you write. So I'm working on that. We have the audio book out. I'm trying to get something going in Hollywood. I'm trying to get Jessica into the classroom. I actually have lesson plans that go with Chasing Vega for teachers. So if they want to teach it as literature, they can. And that's the idea, is to figure out every possible way to get that stuff in front of people. And hopefully someday, maybe, you know what? Make sure you guys send me an email with your t-shirt sizes, and I will send you all some merch with my compliments.
Wow, this is just phenomenal in all sorts of wonderful ways. Jessica Bertus, as somebody who's in the process of putting together your thoughts on Baby, you've graduated, you've got that novel that you're writing, etc. Anything else you'd like to throw to this mix?
I would like to know, well, I wish I could ask for writing advice, but I really want to ask first about how is your family involved in your writing process, or do you like keep it secret? Do you read it to them?
They're a very important part of that process. My wife is, you know, every time I finish a chapter, I read it to her. And, you know, she's the one that says, Terry, this ain't working, or no woman would say that, you know, she changed up my dialogue a lot. So they do. And they're incredibly supportive of Jessica. I mean, it's really, really important, I think, to have that support group. And then the other thing is that, and you'll discover this as you write, is that the author community is very engaging. There really is no competition, because the demand for great stuff far outstrips the supply. When I was in London, I was sitting in the front row to see my friend Don Winslow speak, and there were like five ladies sitting next to me. And I'm thinking, wow, authors my age. They were all silver-haired beauties, you know, from out way outside of London. And I said, tell me what you write. And they say, oh, we don't write. We're here to see Don Winslow. And he only writes one book a year. So what do you write? You know? So that's what I'm dying to hear about what you're thinking about writing, Jessica, because the world needs more great content and great writers. And the only way to become a great writer is to be a bad writer first. You guys got to get out there and do it.
That is very true. Yeah. The more I hear, the more it's, you just have to kind of commit to just writing no matter what, and just see it through. And then you can look back and work on it. So if I can ask, do you have any advice for aspiring authors or just writers?
You know, that's how I started. When I decided I wanted to be an author, I picked my four favorite authors. I picked Dan Brown, James Patterson, Megan Abbott, and Allison Liotta. I picked two men, two women who I admire. And I sent them an email and I said, hey, I'm a guy that's about to turn 65. I'm not stalking you. I'm not asking you to be my mentor. But what I am asking you is, what's one piece of advice you'd give a guy that's starting out in the writing business? And to a person, they went above and beyond. James Patterson gave me the outline to one of his books. So I learned outlining from him. Dan Brown invited me to watch his masterclass. He says, I'm starting my masterclass. Watch that and I'll read a chapter. And Allison and Megan, I mean, same thing. I mean, I feel like they're so far above me, but they're just, the reality is, Jessica, there's not that much difference between you and anybody else that's in the profession. They've just done it longer. You know, that's the only thing. And they know a few more of the tricks. They know how to do it faster. And they know how to, they can sense, the more you read, the better you write. So what I would suggest to you is just dive in. Start, you know, Vega started with the first scene I wrote was the scene at the edge of the cliff, that very first prologue scene. I didn't even know where it was going from that. I just wrote that. Chasing the Captain began with Jessica being forced to go to Nashville to witness an execution in the electric chair. And I didn't even know what story was around that. I wrote that as a short story to go on the blog. I wrote it as a Jessica short story for the blog. I had it narrated and edited and everything. And everybody said, there's got to be more. We got to figure out what's going on. And that became Chasing the Captain. So think about, you know, the world around you is your plot and your characters and stuff. When you're in restaurants, I'm sure you probably listen to people in conversation and stuff. And I'll just take something like that and just run with it and see where it goes. You may throw it away. I would say don't ever throw anything away. Save it in Evernote because it'll come in handy later. But 1,000 words a day. That's my only thing is it would I recommend once you start, write 1,000 words about anything, and it will eventually turn into a story that you'll be proud of.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
It's cardio for the brain, obviously. That's the key thing.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. It's exactly what it is.
We've also got audio versions of the book as well available. You presumably find these all on terryshepherd.com?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and Cynthia Farrell narrates it. She's a Broadway actress and also bilingual, so I think she did a good job. She narrated number one, and I'm going to narrate number two. I didn't think I was going to be a book narrator, but one of the things that Authors on the Air is I read a stanza of my guest books, and that's led to referral business. So I'm on novel number four right now, and I have six more in the queue. So I decided I might as well read my own stuff. So we'll see how I do with a Scottish accent.
It'll be splendid, I have no doubt. Gabriella, any closing thoughts from yourself?
I just wanted to ask you, Terry, you were mentioning your favourite authors there. Do you have like a favourite book that has just been with you since you can remember?
Yeah, The Big Sleep, Raymond Chandler. That one I think is about as perfect a noir novel as that has ever been written. Anything by Megan Abbott, Bury Me Deep by Megan Abbott. That's a book that will make you not want to write because she's so good. It approaches poetry. Anything by Lee Goldberg. If you're writing thrillers, he's the king of thrillers. He's done television. He did Spencer for Hire. He's done a bunch of stuff. He's a mentor. And then I'm surrounded by amazing, female writers. Kate Anslinger is a great, a terrific author. Danielle Gerard was one of my early supporters. She wrote the badass quote from my blurb. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there like that, I've fallen in love with along the way, but Chandler, he had a brief prime, but a brilliant prime. And he wrote, I think, one of the best books that I can always open to any page and find something worth quoting.
The hard-boiled detective genre still actually roots and continues into the 21st century, which is good to hear. Terry, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today and the team. We've got two final questions for you. I think Jessica's going to put them to you in her own inimitable style. Off you go, Jessica.
I'd love to. So, Terry, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer link with us today?
This has been the best one ever.
Oh,
it really has by a mile. I've done probably 24 of these. And your preparation is superlative. Your questions have been great. And it's just delightful. If I were a listener, I would want to listen to this show, even though it's me on it.
That's fantastic to hear. Well, I have high hopes then for the next question. Will you be joining us again?
I would love to. Anytime, any place. What I'll do is I'll make sure that you guys get beta copies of, if you can send me a snail mail address, I'll send you beta copies of the of Chasing the Captain. I'd love to have you tell me what you think I should do to make it better.
This is awesome
thank
material.
You. Oh my goodness.
Thank you.
Terry, we salute you. Keep on keeping on. We will speak again. For the moment, though, happy trails and have a great and wonderful day.
Thank you very much. And I'll see you in the next chapter.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Tinder, Match, Hinge, Bumble, Badoo, Plenty of Fish, Our Time, Muzzmatch. No, not just random words. They're all actually dating apps and online dating services that are from today actually adding new features to their apps and websites to support the government's Every Vaccination Gives Us Hope campaign. Certainly with a recent YouGov poll suggesting that 59% of adults would either prefer their date to be vaccinated or wouldn't date an unvaccinated person. This could be critical in terms of the way we move forward into the post pandemic world. And to actually talk about this, we're delighted to welcome dating coach and dating expert James Priest to the program. How are you, James?
I'm really good, thank you.
Wonderful. So this particular aspect that clearly is there, and I must admit, I'm speaking to somebody who's had his first vaccination jab. He gets his second one in a few weeks' time. But the last thing I'd want to do is to actually post on social media about it. But you would say that actually this is something we should not be wary of. We should actually sort of say, yes, I have been vaccinated. All is well.
That's right. It's just showing the other person when it comes to meeting new people for dating purposes that you're safe to meet. And you are open to go out dating again. and it's like a brand recognition showing that you've done this and you're ready for this.
Now, looking at some of the kind of ways in which these things have been operating, I mean, Hinge actually provides users who participate in their first vaccination campaign a free rose. Plenty of Fish will actually get an I Got My Shot badge to their profiles and so on. Is this, again, a case of how the government is suggesting ways of is it virtue signaling at its worst, or is it just a case of, well, it's just identifying what we are and the fact that we have been vaccinated?
I think it's a great thing that they're doing. Getting these dating apps to team up together to do this is incredible in itself. And what they're doing, they're using it to just raise awareness for the vaccine uptake amongst younger users in particular. And a lot of these apps have got younger users who are out there wanting to interact, chomping at the bit to go out dating again. So it is a really, really good place to reach these people.
Now, I've got to say, I've heard of one or two of these apps, never actually used them. But from the perspective of looking at the sequence, is this something which is becoming more and more prevalent? I mean, I think there was a time a few years ago where almost using a dating app would be seen as almost equivalent to an admission of failure, that you couldn't actually connect IRL in real life, so it had to be a virtual connection.
That was a long time ago. The taboos and the embarrassments of online dating and dating apps have long gone. I think one in three people have got apps on their phone right now, and that's increasing all the time. People are on multiple apps. They're going out there because it's the best way to reach new people, particularly during a pandemic. When you can't go out and meet people from events, from parties, or from work, how else do you meet people? Going on the apps. And over the last year, these apps' use have increased by about 300%. So they are completely cool. Everyone's using them, from people who are late teenagers up to people in their 80s. They're incredibly popular.
So which ones do you feel have been particularly successful? Or is it a case that they're all very successful? It doesn't matter whether you're actually dealing with badges or indeed stickers or virtual worlds or indeed the OkCupid's vaccinated stack. They're all kind of worthwhile to access.
You can use as many dating apps as you like, but it's all down to how you present yourself if you want to get attention. So you've got to have a great profile, you've got to have great pictures and send great messages. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what apps and sites you're using, you're not going to do very well. It's about marketing. Use any of the apps out there. We've got a whole load of them. Tinder, Bumble, Match, Hinge, so many of these sites. And there's so much to choose from. And they've all got their own unique databases. So giving one a try, but doing it properly is my best advice. Because most people do it, and they do it half-heartedly, and they don't know what they're doing. So if you want to do it the best way you can, with the best impressions and the best images.
I was intrigued to actually find in Muzzmatch you actually have a range of medics who actually will answer users' most pressing questions about the vaccine. That's also going to be running across social media challenges, despite the fact that clearly there's been, I mean, this is quite clearly an unprecedented campaign which has been rolled out. There still seem to be many people who are either bemused or uncertain or unclear or indeed simply untrustworthy about what is being put out by mainstream media in general.
That's very true. People are unsure about this, and I think three quarters of people are very supportive of this. But there are people that are confused and don't really agree with doing this, but that's absolutely fine, because what dating apps do is they help you attract like-minded people. You've got to have the same interests and the same beliefs in life anyway. So having a badge on your profile is a really good thing, because it just attracts someone else who thinks the same as you. If they haven't got a badge, maybe you can reach out to them and say, well, both haven't got badges, let's start a conversation anyway.
From the perspective of obviously the importance of being vaccinated, it's worth noting that vaccinated people are much more unlikely to get serious COVID-19, much less likely to be admitted to hospital, and accordingly much less likely to die from it. And perhaps even more significant, there's growing evidence that vaccinated people are less likely to pass the virus on to others. So there is a very serious point in terms of this. Again, is it one of those aspects in terms of how do we actually ensure that we all, 7 billion of us on a planet or thereabouts, can effectively sort of engage in something which is not only protecting ourselves, but also protecting our loved ones?
That's very true. Well, having the vaccine itself is one of the most important things that you can do to keep yourself safe and also others, like you pointed out just now. And when it comes to dating, it's not just about you, it's about the person you're meeting, making them feel safe and putting others first. So go out there, get the jab, and make sure that when you meet somebody, that you're not putting anyone at risk.
And in terms of, what I say, going through the process of dating and the minefields that people will actually say from that perspective, is it a case of you simply actually take those first steps and say, what the hey, we'll go with this? Or are there certain sort of precautions you should put in place all the time?
Well, your safety always comes first. The place you meet someone should be a public place. That's pretty obvious in itself. But go out there and just maybe talk to someone on the phone before you even meet them. There's no reason why you have to rush into meeting somebody face to face. I always recommend a 10-minute conversation with somebody that you've met on the dating apps, just to see if you are a good fit anyway. And then you can have a conversation, and then you can arrange and plan a really safe date. If you're going to plan a date, I do recommend that having the vaccine is very, very important, but also remember things like hands, face, space, and fresh air. So you can just make sure everyone is safe and you're both completely comfortable with doing this.
And where would you recommend people should actually go to find out further details about the many and varied vaccine stickers and things that you can find on, as we mentioned, Tinder, Match and Our Time, OkCupid, Hinge, Plenty of Fish, Bumble, Badoo and Muzzmatch?
Well, each of these different apps have got their own information on the apps. When you get the badges, it will ask you questions and explain more to you. If you want to find that more generally, you can go to the gov.uk website.
James Priest, dating coach and dating expert. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and continue being safe.
Lending quality chat and insightful comment for the 21st century. You're listening to the Midweek Drive.
Well, cryptocurrency. You may only have a vague notion of what cryptocurrency is, but over 1 in 10 people in the East Midlands have now purchased cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, and 1/4 of people in the East Midlands plan on taking money out of their savings account in the next 6 months to invest elsewhere. Now, to actually address the issues of cryptocurrency and so on, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, the founder and chief executive officer of Zigloo. That's the wonderful Mark Hipperson. How are you, Mark?
Morning, Alex. I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Excellent. And we also have personal finance expert and Ace, founder of the wonderful moneycoms.co.uk. That's Andrew Hagger with us. How are you, Andrew?
I'm very well. Thank you, Alex.
Good. Andrew, if we can come to you first, just explain for the benefit of the listener the whole aspect of cryptocurrency, because it can get a little bit complex in terms of people appreciating what it is we're talking about here. It's almost cryptic in its own sense of what we're about.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's basically it's a digital currency. And the way it gets its name is the currency is actually built on a sort of platform called blockchain, which basically every transaction that's made, a little addition is made to the blockchain. But that blockchain is then protected by sort of crypto technology. Hence, that's where the name cryptocurrency comes from. So you're pretty familiar with Bitcoin, but there are sort of hundreds of other sort of smaller, lesser well-known currencies out there as well now.
Now, Mark, you've actually co-founded a UK retail bank. You've got two financial technology businesses. You are, as we mentioned, the founder and chief executive officer of Zigloo, and you've launched the world's first truly integrated crypto challenger. So is this something which is kind of growing in popularity, or are you still getting a large number of people who actually say, yeah, this all sounds great, but personally, I don't think we should ever have done away with bartering in terms of the ways forward as far as finances are maintained?
Thanks, Alex. Well, I founded Zigloo because people wanted to find out more about cryptocurrencies and wanted a simple, straightforward and regulated company to be able to buy it from. And I was pleased to say that we were the UK's first regulated company for both cryptocurrency and also your normal sort of banking needs, your currency needs. So we came at it from a perspective of doing it correctly and doing it in a way that's fully regulated, which people want, of course. And so we've made it straightforward and simple for people to be able to buy a sort of curated list of the most popular cryptocurrencies in an environment where people just download an app, go through an onboarding process, and then have simple, straightforward access to currencies where in the past they weren't able to do that.
Andrew, what are the risks that are actually entailed with this? Because clearly with any activity that human beings engage in, there's a certain amount of risk. Lord knows we do sufficient features and focuses on the dangers of online security and having data taken and all the rest of the bits and pieces. What are the kind of challenges with respect to somebody who's thinking, well, you know, maybe this sounds too good to be true and maybe it is too good to be true. What's it all about?
I think if you go through a registered platform like Zigloo, the safety aspect there is covered. But I guess the biggest concern to people will be, will I make money? Will I lose money? And much like stocks and shares, the crypto markets can be quite volatile, sometimes even more volatile. So there is a potential for you to make money or lose money. So if you're going to invest, don't put money in that you can't afford to lose. I mean, the latest research that Zigloo put out found that majority of people, particularly younger people, were perhaps putting in £100 or £200. So fairly small amounts just to sort of get used to how it all works. And then there's people who are perhaps in the older age bracket, got a bit more disposable income, and they're putting a bit more in there. But, you know, the market can move quite quickly one way or the other. You may well benefit, you may not. But Bitcoin's been around for 12 years now, so it's not something that's just appeared overnight. But I think more people are talking about it, more people are getting interested in it.
But looking at the figures that over half of folk in the East Midlands are actually using money from their savings to actually purchase cryptocurrencies, it does seem as though it's not going away. Mark, clearly Zigloo is one of those areas that's set up to hopefully provide a useful service for this. What personally attracted you to the whole field of cryptocurrency? Is it a case of wanting to be ahead of the curve, or was it just a case of, well, it sounds interesting?
Well, 3 or 4 years ago, I didn't know much about it. You know, when I was starting bank, I decided I wanted to do something else in financial services, but something that was just topical for where the country was going, and trying to be a little bit ahead of the curve, because I could see even back then that people wanted to get involved in cryptocurrency, but didn't know how to do that in a safe and simple manner. So I learned about it myself and took some time out to be able to learn about the different elements of how it worked, so that when I launched and founded Zigloo, I put all those learnings into bringing the best together of traditional financial services with exchanges. So trying to be a bit ahead of a curve and provide something that I thought people would want. And as we've seen, certainly in the last, I guess, year or so, certainly in the last 6 months, it's been a particular interest in cryptocurrency. And, you know, we've been there to be able to provide that service to people.
Certainly, I suppose you mentioned interest, though. I mean, interestingly enough, as interest rates have actually obviously plummeted and remain fairly low, is that an incentive for people to actually look at something like cryptocurrency, indeed swapping low-risk accounts for high-risk investments? Is that part of the attraction for this?
Well, it is, of course, yeah, because, you know, we've had, you know, lowest interest rates in obviously any country's history globally, of course. So people aren't getting a return on their money at the moment. So the alternative has been to put it into other asset classes, and cryptocurrency is one of those asset classes. And we've seen there's a degree of volatility in that. So what we did in the last week is launch a sterling based investment account. So you don't have to convert your fiat currency, your sterling into a cryptocurrency. We just pay you 5% interest on that through our account. So we give people the benefits of having low volatility, i.e. it's in sterling, but the benefits of a high interest rate as well.
Andrew, I was really surprised to find that it's nearly 3/4 of cryptocurrency owners are actually men. Was that a gender imbalance that you weren't expecting? Did that catch you by surprise? Or was it just a case of men tend to be a little bit more financially risk proactive than women, possibly?
Yeah, I think I did expect to see a sway that way. Maybe not quite as much, I guess. But yeah, I guess men are more prone to take risks with their money. You know, there's a lot of people who sort of gamble on football and racing and things like that. And they have money that they're happy to to put to one side, and if they lose it, they lose it. And I think perhaps some people have taken that same sort of mindset when it comes to crypto. You know, they've seen that people have made some good money on it, and they, you know, they want to give it a go, but they do understand that perhaps it might not always go their way, and they may end up getting back less than they put in. But you know, it's been around for 12 years now. It's not an overnight thing, and I think it's an area that will continue to grow, and more people will want to get involved, even if it's just in a small way.
Yeah, although interesting, it's only 2% over 65s who actually seem to be investing in it. So certainly, yeah, you might sort of see that maybe we become less risk taking as we become more chronologically gifted. Mark, where can people go to find out further details initially about Zigloo and indeed what we've been speaking about today?
Well, they can go to our website, Alex, which is zigloo.io, or download our app from Google Store or Apple Store.
Excellent. And presumably, Andrew, it's moneycoms.co.uk to find out further details about your own interest and recommendations when it comes to finance.
That's absolutely spot on. Thanks, Alex. Yeah.
Splendid. Incidentally, Andrew, have you invested in cryptocurrency as yet? Is it a case of, no, I couldn't possibly do that, I have to remain completely neutral?
No, I have. Yeah, not a massive amount, but yeah, I've dabbled, and yeah, so far so good. I think, I think to do this job, you have to get involved. You have to get involved to understand it, really.
In the classic lines of the chap who actually sort of was falling off a skyscraper as he passed each floor, so far so good, so far so good. Just a line that comes from The Magnificent Seven. It's a wonderful thing. Mark Ipperson, founder and CEO of Zigloo, and Andrew Hagger, personal finance expert and founder of moneycomes.co.uk. Keep on keeping on and be well, gentlemen.
Thanks, Alex. Goodbye.
Well, we've just been talking about cryptocurrency, which is all to do with finance, and finance does become more and more complex and confusing, it would seem, or maybe there's just consumer credit confusion with respect to how people actually deal with their credit reports, etc. And when you get a report that suggests that a third of people think that when they're refused credit, it will show on their credit report, and indeed not understanding why the situation is going to cause challenges for them, we clearly need to bring in two ace individuals, and it's always a delight to welcome these two fine folk to the studio. First of all, Equifax Head of Consumer Experience, that's Lisa Hardstaff. How are you, Lisa?
I'm very well, Alex.
And our ace young money blogger extraordinaire and finance expert personified, it's Iona Bain. How are you, Iona?
I'm great, Alex, thank you.
Excellent. So, Iona, if we come to you first, were you surprised by this finding? Did you think that, well, you know, people get turned down and think, oh, no, that's it, I'm doomed, the mark of Cain has been put against me financially, my whole world is over?
Well, that's definitely not the case. It's not the end of the world if you are refused credit. I think the most important thing is to ask your lender why that's happened, and then try to make sure that you are taking those steps to improve your credit report. And so I think this report isn't all that surprising because, you know, in my work, I come across a lot of people who are very confused about credit reports and scores and what lenders look at when it comes to deciding whether to give you credit or not. And I think what you mentioned there with regards to the number of people who incorrectly think that their credit report will show how many times they've been rejected for credit, I think it's just worth stressing that, yes, your lenders will see how many credit applications have been made on your file. And if you have got quite a lot in a short space of time, then that can be a red flag. But the credit report doesn't specifically show whether you have been declined or accepted for credit. So it's understanding things like that that can really help you just get more informed about your credit report and then take those steps to improve your credit score and give yourself a better chance of being accepted for credit in the future.
Lisa, in terms of the myths that have emerged within this, I was fascinated to find that a number of people actually think that your bank account actually sort of can have a positive impact on the credit score. Just talk us through some of those myth findings and things which people are kind of believing, well, you know, this is the case when actually it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, sort of one of the big myths is, you know, that a whole load of other things that you may put on an application form are in your credit report. So things like who your employer is, you know, where you work, how much salary you earn. None of that is on your credit report. That is on your application form that you will put into a lender, but it's not on your credit report. Other things that like you know, parking fines, and child maintenance is often another one that people think are on it. That's not on your credit report. Your credit report is simply what it says. It is a report that provides information to you and to the lenders about how you have managed your credit. So it is what you would expect. It is your credit cards, your loans, your bank information, you know, if you've got an overdraft with them, it's mortgages, it's your utilities, it's your broadband, it's your mobile phone contracts. Any scenario where you are effectively being lent credit for a product or a service, which you have to then pay back. That's kind of the information that will appear on your credit report, along with what we call public information, which is whether you're on the electoral roll, because lenders need to know that, to know that you live at the address you've put on the application form, and whether you've had a bankruptcy ruling. So you've got a CCJ or an IVA against your name, because what lenders have to do is they have got to lend responsibly. That is their requirement. And to do that, they look at the risk of lending to you, and that takes into consideration the information we've just talked about, and whether you can afford it. And this still takes into consideration the stuff that you'll put on your application form. So where you work, how long you've worked, part-time, full-time, what are your outgoings, your gym membership, your childcare costs. And that they pull together to define your credit worthiness. And based on that, they will make a decision.
Iona, you're probably far too young to remember the Lehman Brothers cash crises and the scenarios that occurred in what was probably one of the biggest events that have impacted us prior to the pandemic. These days, it's all minor by comparison. But do you think that that sort of tendency, as Lisa's just actually said there, of ensuring that, you know, what this is, what this has at its heart is ensuring that responsible lending is maintained. And it's not simply a case of, well, yeah, have as much money as you want, but you're going to have to pay it back with lots of interest, and we're going to bankrupt you in several years to come.
Well, I'm definitely not too young to remember Lehman Brothers, although I was at university at the time. And I think ever since then, really, I've been trying to kind of help people through my work understand that there isn't such a thing as good or bad debt per se. It's about how you manage debt. And credit is a fact of life. You know, most of us will at some point in our life want to take out credit in order to achieve a really important dream of ours, you know, whether that's getting on the housing ladder or starting up a business. So in order to do that, we have to have that credit profile. We have to be able to show lenders that we can be relied upon to pay back what we owe. Because, I mean, I think it was Bob Hope who once said, you know, if you owe the bank £100 and you don't pay it back, then that's your problem. But if you owe them, you know, £100,000 and you don't pay it back, then that's the bank's problem. Actually, it is still your problem. Whatever you owe, if you're in debt, then you have a responsibility to make sure that you are paying back what you owe. And I mean, look, we can all get into problems with debt. I think, you know, very few of us could just sail through life never experiencing any difficulties with debt. As I said, it's a fact of life. And it's not the end of the world if we get into a bit of a rough patch with our credit score, but we can do things to improve it. And some of the things that we can do are really easy, such as getting on the electoral register, making sure there aren't any errors on our report, and just making sure that we are paying our bills on time, that we are paying back all our credit agreements on time and in full. And if we do that, then we are going to start building that positive credit picture and giving lenders the confidence to be able to say, okay, this person, you know, they're going to pay back what they owe. You know, I'm not going to be taking too much of a risk if I lend money to this person. It's okay. So I think it's something that you can't hope to achieve overnight. And that's a big frustration for younger people, especially those looking to get on the housing ladder. It takes time. But if you just invest that little bit of effort in checking your credit report and really take those steps to improve it over time, then you will start to reap the rewards.
And returning to yourself, Lisa, just in terms of actually quizzing people in terms of why people have been turned down for credit, presumably you would encourage people to actually not simply just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, that's it, it's all over. Actually, just find out a little bit why. As Iona's just said there, the importance of checking that your information is accurate is vital, I would have thought.
Absolutely. I mean, I would always say, you know, if you're planning to take out credit or ask for credit, it's worth understanding what's on your credit report. And, you know, if there's anything that is an issue there, we have traffic lighting on our credit reports that show red, you've got, this is having a problem with you getting credit, amber, this could be a problem, and green, everything's good. You know, look at them and see what you can do. There are links to FAQs and articles to help you do that. But I think you need to understand what the lender is going to be looking at when they make the consideration. And the big thing here is, you know, don't be frightened of this. This is all fixable if something is wrong on it. And if it's good, you want to maintain it because, you know, the higher your score, the more likely you're going to get the good deals with the low interest and what have you. So it is definitely worth doing. And, you know, just check on it. Yeah, absolutely.
And just finally, where would you recommend people should actually go, Lisa, to actually check out some of the things we've been talking about today and the Equifax report?
Okay, so they can go to equifax.co.uk where they can sort of sign up for our service if they wish to. But there is also an area on our website called the Knowledge Centre where we've got loads of articles and how to, you know, get ready for a mortgage and a budget planner and stuff like that, which is available to anybody, not just our customers.
And Iona, clearly we need to plug your blog as well from that point of view. Where can people actually find out more Iona Bain information? As you know, we won't rest until everybody actually has a virtual Iona Bain that pops up and just say, this is what we should be doing.
No pressure. No pressure, Alex. So you can find me at youngmoneyblog.co.uk and I'm on Twitter as well at Iona Young Money.